get sneaky. Maury Rose, a two-time winner, takes the lead from Faulkner. That's the way they finish the first lap.
Welcome to another episode of Pit Lane Parlay. I am your host, Mike Jocum. Matt is here. We have plenty of IndyCar and Texas to talk about, but first, I want to send our condolences to the Unser family for Bobby Unser passing away on Monday, I believe it was. I obviously didn't see him race when I was growing up, but my dad said he was kind of like, if you were to compare him to a current driver, similar to a Pato Award, somebody who didn't really care about necessarily saving tires or saving fuel and just was kind of a genuine badass and gave it 110% every lap at every track he ran. So very sad to see three-time Indy 500 winner and obviously one of the most famous names in racing and a very nice guy even in his later years. I talked to him briefly in the elevator at IMS a couple of years ago. I don't know if you have anything to add or we can go on.
Yeah, obviously three-time Indy 500 champion, so he knew what he was doing there. And I think outside of that, he was a great commentator too with Sam Posey and Paul Page. I think they made a great team all those years for CART. And then I think Danny Sullivan came along the way. It was just Sullivan and Page. But I thought he had a lot of great insights there. And once told Sam Posey that he was wrong about Little Al's braking abilities. I thought it was funny to do that live on air. So just think of the Unser family. Obviously, it's a big loss for the IndyCar community, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in Albuquerque who are, you know, thinking of the Unser family right now. So we'll keep them in our thoughts.
So, Texas, before we dive into the replays or replays, whatever. It doesn't even matter anymore. Matt, you were there on Saturday. What were your at-track observations, thoughts? Did we get any food reviews that are about to be published?
Yeah, we got one coming. Or one has just been published. I'll share it here soon. I forgot to turn my camera sideways again. It's my first one of the year, okay? So, yeah, the first one I did a selfie review while I was waiting for Sammy and my buddy Abel to show up, and then the other I did four more that I had camera support for. So Texas, it's huge. I obviously know it's a big track, but man, you get there and it's just massive. Media Center is quite cool. It was a suite in the front stretch towards the sort or just after start finish. So that was a great view of practice there. Got to talk to Krista Hardy and Dejewski in the press box. That was really cool. And staff was very friendly. So thank you, Texas, for allowing me the access there. It was really nice of you guys. Food reviews are coming soon. And then, yeah, the race was, I know how races work. I know that when you are live in person, you definitely get more of the full scope, especially in ovals where you can see the whole track. Versus when you're watching on TV and they maybe are just focused on the front three while Marcus Ericsson's sending it on someone in the back of the field and they don't show it. So, like, yeah. You know, I get that sense there. And then, you know, I'm checking Twitter and everybody's freaking out about how bad the race is. And I'm not saying it doesn't look great on TV because it probably didn't. At least that first one didn't. But I think in person you get definitely more of a feel for it and you also see a lot more action. The ends of the stints were phenomenal at race one. I'm guessing that you guys didn't get that sense on TV maybe, but it was a lot of fun at the track and definitely made me appreciate Texas a little more. So thanks again to them for letting me there.
Honestly, I have plenty to say that could be critical of Texas, but I mean, listen, Saturday was far from, you know, the most exciting, close to the exciting race I've ever watched, but you know, those ends of the stints, like you mentioned, were pretty nuts. And I know we were only seeing probably a quarter of what, you know, you and people at the track were seeing. So I kind of just like accepted it that, listen, that's what I'm going to get because I'm on TV and, you know, didn't get too hung up on it. But Race one recap, top five, Scott Dixon, Scott McLaughlin with his first career podium in his first career oval race, Pato O'Ward with his first podium of the year, Alex Palou and Graham Rahal. And where do we want to start here? All right, let's start with Joseph Newgarden, who didn't had a I don't know. What did you make of the Newgarden Bourdais thing? Because everybody has very different standpoints on this.
Yeah, I was actually I was fortunate to have my eyes trained on that as it happened. And, you know, I only realized till after the crash, I'm like, that was Newgarden, like as he was going down the backstretch. I couldn't tell who hit him, but then I, you know, once I figured it out, it was like, wow, I can't believe Newgarden just hit him. So, you know, looking at the replay, I do sympathize for him. I think penalty might have been pretty harsh. I wouldn't consider it avoidable contact. I'm not sure there was a whole lot Newgarden can do. I mean, Herta was going very slow through the exit of turn two with, I'm assuming, his very old tires. And if memory serves me correct, Harvey had just passed Herta. So I'm assuming that may have disturbed the air for Herta even more. So then Bourdais was there, and then Newgarden arrived on the scene, and Bourdais lifted to avoid running in the back of Herta, and Newgarden just didn't have the time to check up. So I'm not entirely sure what Newgarden is supposed to do on that. You know, sending him to the back, I think, is the nicest penalty they could have given him. You know, I think a drive-through would have been really harsh. I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess my point is I'm not sure what Newgarden was supposed to do on that one. I don't think it wasn't, like, deliberate or anything.
No, I think it was one of those racing deals. I'm fine with calling it avoidable contact, especially since they just sent him to the back. Obviously, he rebounded to finish sixth, so he had a good rest of the race. Probably took him out of podium contention, but listen, it's tough. Herta was definitely slow, and Bourdais slowed down, so there wasn't really anywhere for Newgarden to go. And I don't know if there was room behind him. Maybe he could have slowed down, but now you're just splitting hairs to find a reason. Listen, in the end, not a huge deal. Sucks for Bourdais, obviously, because he got taken out in the melee on Sunday, but James Hinchcliffe also had a rough crash towards the end after Felix Rosenqvist passed him, I think it was. It was a car with a blue on it.
Yep, it was really
and nice. He went up into the wall, had no air to, you know, got that wave of dirty air, crashed into the wall. And then the big story of the weekend was, I guess, Jack Harvey and his on-track defense, let's call it. So first was Alex Rossi. I didn't really think the Alex Rossi, Jack Harvey thing was really anything that needed to, like, be talked about more. And then people really seemed to talk about it on social media. So let's start there. Any thoughts? Were you fine with no penalty on that one?
I was fine with no penalty on both of them. Yeah. I think the Rossi one was worse, in my opinion. I
agree.
I know it's restart, and I know everybody's kind of on top of each other there, but I think it's either he wasn't getting the best spotter knowledge or he wasn't checking his mirror. But in the trioval, the worst thing you could do is put someone in the grass. That's pretty dangerous. So, again, I don't know if he just didn't get the call or what, but I think if someone's even if they're in the wrong, if someone's trying your inside in the trioval, you kind of have to give it to him because Rossi – thankfully saved it, but if he doesn't save that, that's a massive crash for everybody behind him. That's, you know, an 8-car crash in the making. So I'm fine with the no penalty. It's kind of just a coaching moment for next time, because that was definitely on the verge of very unsafe.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if it was a spotter thing or just, you know, this is only the second time he's been at Texas and the first time he's really been on pace at Texas. So I'm fine. Listen, I'm fine with that one. All right, Graham Rahal. So, obviously, going down the back straight, Graham goes to make is prepping to make a move. The replay shows that Harvey dives down first in anticipation of a Rahal move, which is technically legal. Let's get your thoughts on it first, and then we'll discuss the the discussion after the race.
Yeah, this one, I mean, dangerous, sure. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely putting the passing car in a compromising situation, especially if they can't get it executed by the time we get to the banking. So that's it's pretty risky. But, you know, watching the races back, Harvey was definitely not the only person doing that. It's not like he was the big bad wolf out there doing this over and over again. You know, other people are doing it as well. That seems more like a race control issue, like, you know, making, like, enforcing the fact that you can't go below the white line. So, like, if you are Graham Ray Hall and Harvey puts his car there, then you're going to have to go to the outside or something. Or you could turn it back on Harvey and say that he forced Ray Hall below the white line and therefore Harvey gets the penalty. But that turns into kind of a slippery slope. So I think, you know, just coming up with some system saying you just can't go down there, I think would be a start. But given the circumstances and the fact that others were doing the exact same, I think Harvey was technically fine with what he did. And I didn't see too much of an issue with it given the laws of the race.
Yeah, I mean, the rules of the race show you can't be reactive, but you can be proactive. And if you look at the replay, Jack Harvey clearly moved first. It was dangerous, yeah. It wasn't too much different than the Simon Pagenaud-Alex Rossi battle at the 500 in 2019. Seemed similar to that. So, yeah, listen, I feel bad for Graham because he definitely had the pace to get by Harvey there and maybe go up the field a little bit more than he did, but I don't see any issue with that. Now, after the race, Graham Ray Hall, in a very measured response, I don't think he was kind of out of line with his interview, said, hey, listen, Jack and I, we need to talk. You know, just man to man, need to talk. Okay, fine. Jack Harvey asked about it. He says he knows where to find me. Obviously, the IndyCar broadcast tried to make that a battle royale that wasn't there. But do you have any issue with Graham's response or Jack's response or anything along those lines?
I didn't think Harvey versus Ray Hall was the rivalry that we needed to get us through that Saturday. That was kind of fun. I think I have like a general comment, I guess, about post-race interviews by drivers or just any sort of interview by drivers is that if Graham Ray Hall got out of the car and the interviewer asked him, hey, you brought the car home P5. Looks like you guys had a great race. Tell me what your thoughts were about the race. If the first thing that he said was, well, that damn Jack Harvey, I need to go teach him a lesson, then I could see that where it's be like, wow, Graham Ray Hall's whiner. Graham Ray Hall needs to shut up and drive, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if he gets out of the car and the first question he's asked is, what happened there with Jack Harvey? I think Ray Hall is kind of inclined to give a direct answer. As long as he's not, you know, I think overbearing or too harsh, there's nothing wrong with what he said. You know, he said, I need to have a talk with him. I didn't like what he did, et cetera, et cetera. People on social media were saying, you know, like Graham Ray Hall is a whiner. I don't like Graham Ray Hall anymore for what he said. It's like, well, what is he, if he's asked a question about Jack Harvey, is he just supposed to say, hey, I'm going to go get some ice cream with him and laugh about how he just blocked me down the backstretch. Like, I'm not sure what he's supposed to answer there to make people happy.
Yeah, he's had his moments where he's blamed other people, but I really have no issue with the actual response. He wasn't blaming Jack Harvey. He just said, hey, I just want to talk to him and see what was up. That's kind of how I took what he said.
Yeah, and I think that would also apply to other drivers. You know, I think Will Power has a tendency to give direct answers. We know Sebastian Bourdais gives direct answers. And I think if you are someone who's interviewing them and ask them a direct question, I think the fans at home need to understand that if they're asked specifically to talk about it, they're going to give a direct answer. Whether you like it or not, that's just kind of their opinion, especially he was, what, 5 minutes removed from the cockpit? Like, it was just fresh in his head. So I definitely appreciate the fact that Graham Ray Hall was honest enough to just, like, say, like, hey, I need to go talk to him because I didn't like it. And, you know, I appreciate that because, you know, emotion is good, especially when it's emotion curtailed with rationality. He wasn't being obtuse with his comments. He was very smart with what he said, and I appreciated it. So,
sorry, I don't know if it was you who said this on social media or if I read it, but it's like if Graham comes out and says, yeah, I need to talk to him like he did, people are crucifying him on social media. But then again, if he says nothing, people are also crucifying him on social media. It's like no matter what Graham Ray Hall does in that case, people are going to be angry on social media, which is really insufferable.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, like I said, if he's asked a question about it, what is he supposed to say?
Yeah.
So anyways, we can put that one to bed probably. It made for some fun times on social media, I guess. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. So if you do think Graham Rahal's a whiner, I mean, we do have evidence of the past of him whining. I don't think this was one per se, but he has done it before for sure. Race two, Pato O'Ward gets his first career win. So congrats to Pato. Yeah. Big Pato guys on this podcast here. Newgarden finished second. No penalties this race for him. Rahal third. Dixon fourth, despite leading 130 something laps. And Colton Herta finishing fifth. Obviously, the major headline for this race, other than Pato winning, was that insane crash at the start. To recap it, they were coming to green. The green flag waved. And right around row four or five, people started checking up. And Pietro Fittipaldi ran at the back of Bourdais. Bourdais slid into the inside lane and hooked Rossi. And then calamity ensued. In total, I think seven cars retired. The scariest part was Connor Daly arriving at the scene. And I watched a fan replay of it from the stands. And I guess this is going to be something we talk about once we get past our driver of the day and disappointment of the day. Connor Daly was kind of late arriving to the scene. You know, he was not packed up to the grid when the green flag waved. And that's not Connor Daly's fault. That's, you know, everybody's really sprawled out. And so he's just trying to hustle to get to the group. So it's not really anything he did wrong. But when he showed up, he had much more speed than everybody else. And so when he tried to follow Hinch through the gap, he hit Kellett and somebody else and then flipped his car. And thankfully didn't hit the fence, and all the safety improvements and whatnot did their jobs. So he was completely fine as far as what I've read. So a lot of torn up cars. So what were your, first of all, there were opinions out there that Pietro Fittipaldi caused this crash. Wanted to get your thoughts on that. And then secondly, we can just do this debate now, I guess. Is there anything that we need to do with the start procedures? Because this also happened in a, you know, obviously less violent form in Gateway last year. Kind of the same thing.
So, yeah, I mean, even Graham Rahal said in the post-race press conference on Sunday that he did feel like the guys at the front were going pretty slow. So I'm not putting the blame on Fittipaldi. I think, you know, as a driver, you're taught when you see the green flag, you hustle, you get going. And obviously he was just a little trigger happy there with everything going on in front of him. So I don't think there's necessarily, like, you can't blame, let's say, Scott Dixon up front for going slow because he sets the pace going to the green flag. At the same time, Fittipaldi is just trying to react what's going on around him and just ran out of braking room. So it's like one of those racing deals that just has a lot of facets to it. So I have a hard time really blaming, like, one, like, I don't think you can pin it on one guy or one thing. It was like, you know, slow cars at the front maybe, or in the midfield, some guys checked up, some guys saw the green flag and went, and, you know, guys like Connor Daly are starting last, so they're kind of catching up, and they see that green flag, and they try to go for a spot that Hinchcliffe, you know, barely snuck through, and obviously the rest is history. So I'm honestly not going to blame it on, I don't think it's right to blame it on one person or one thing.
And then anything with the restart as or starting procedures as a whole that needs to be changed?
I want to say, like, yeah, sure, because I don't want to see that happen again. But other than saying the leader has to accelerate by, you know, the green X on the track at a given track, what are you going to do? I don't think there's much you can do. If the leader sets the pace, you have to follow the leader and accept the risks that sometimes this thing is going to happen because some people get more trigger happy. So unless you say, listen, 200 feet before the start finish line, there's a proverbial green X that Scott Dixon must start accelerating at, I think that's the only thing you can do.
Yeah. And I guess, well, first of all, no, it's not Fittipaldi's fault, and anybody implying otherwise, I think, is it's ridiculous to blame him for that. I was trying to think of several examples I could use of this same thing happening. I mean, Grand Rahal turned Piggott in Pocono in 2018. There was Gateway last year. One of the years at Barber, someone spun Alocin and Munoz or something. But this isn't like the first time this has happened. And each time it's happened, I've never seen, you know, someone just like blatantly at fault. Rahal Pocono was a little iffy. He was going way faster than everybody else. But no, this one, I mean, what is Fittipaldi supposed to do? If Bourdais in front of him checks up at the last second while he's on full throttle, there's only so much reaction time a human can have to do something about it. So I don't blame that on him. I hope he's not beating himself up over it, because, yeah, I think anybody could see that. It wasn't really like something that was blatantly his fault. And then I do think there is something that can be done. I think that last pace lap, they could go a little slower. Thinking like specifically the leaders, like if they get to turn one, they can start to slow down a little bit, or, you know, allow the field to catch up. Because, you know, one of the observations I had from the first race was, you know, when they threw the one to go sign for the race start, and the leaders are crossing like start finish line, and the rear of the field was exiting turn two. And I'm like, that is a large gap for them to catch in not a lot of time, especially when the field's going to be super slow. So I don't think, you know, like with Daly going full bore to catch the field as the green flag's being dropped, I don't think that should ever happen. And again, it's not Daly's fault, but I don't know if cars need to be a little closer together when they're warming up their tires, or if they need to go slower on that last lap and start forming up in turn one instead of the halfway down the backstretch. I think there's something that can be done, but
that's a good point. I mean, you could say that for ovals or non-ovals, that whole last lap you need to be packed up instead of like the last two corners. That's a fair point.
Because I was watching Grosjean's first lap on board that he posted on his YouTube, and if you see it, he's like row 4 or 5. Yeah. He's not back in the back of the field, and that fast left right before like the turn and the pit entrance, he's like just now, like where Jimmy Johnson spun is basically where he filled into his gap. I'm like, why are we filling in our gaps, you know, less than half a mile before the start finish line? I think it's like a third of a mile. Basically, he filled his spot with like half a turn to go. So I think they should maybe They should start to grid cars a little sooner when their formation before we get there. Because I think, you know, like Indy, they start to do it the extra turn too, but they have, you know, a mile and a quarter to go before they get to the start finish. So that's plenty of time. I don't understand why they don't do that at more tracks. So I think that's something that could be done to maybe help a little, per se. Anyways, yeah, glad everybody got out of that safe. Glad Connor was all right, because that was pretty nasty. Yep. But Pato gets his first career win. I think it was a long time coming, because he's had a couple close calls here. A, wanted to get your thoughts on that, and then B, not going to leave it up to opinion here, why was race two so much better than race one?
So, first off, you know, big congrats to Pato. I still remember one of the first in-person interviews I ever did was on stage with him at Gateway a few years ago when it was literally like 120 degrees. And he took a lot of time. He had some really funny answers, probably that an IndyCar team wouldn't be too thrilled with, but Indy Lights was, I guess, not as worried about that. And it was pretty funny. But I also want to give a shout out to Taylor Kyle, because the team put him in a really good position strategy wise on Saturday to, you know, be out on fresher tires, maybe a little bit before everybody else and keep pace, and obviously gave him just enough fuel to make it home on Sunday for the win. So the team, who's kind of put him in a couple rough spots over the last year and a quarter, put him in a really good spot all weekend, but great to see. And I think why was Sunday? Yes, Sunday was the first half of the race. I was going, oh no, Scott Dixon's going to lead like 198 laps and win hands down, and everybody is literally going to blow up over Texas. There was a lot going on. I don't know if it was because they raced there twice and that bottom lane was rubbered in, but guys were getting pretty ballsy with their passes, and there was a lot going on everywhere on track. You know, everywhere you looked, Ray Hall was making a charge for the lead. It's almost like Saturday was practice, and they figured out, okay, if I back off a little bit heading into turn one or turn three, I can use the corner to build up momentum and make a pass on the straightaways. And that strategy seemed to really work for, you know, Ray Hall made a couple moves. Obviously, Jack Harvey made a couple moves on a restart. I think he went from like sixth to third. Pato went from...
Stay ahead of the pack with the latest racing news and interviews from the Hammerdown Racing Report, your source for regional racing action as well as the national scene. Every week, we recap racing action from all around Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan and cover national racing series from the World of Outlaws to NASCAR. Plus, get all the latest racing news. Join hosts Scott Hammer and Ron Miller, along with different featured guests each week. From dirt to asphalt, we have you covered. The Hammerdown Racing Report, available weekly on your favorite podcasting platform.
Running should be simple. Just put on your shoes and go. And yet, when you try to learn about how to get better at it, especially as you age, you're confronted with conflicting advice, complicated workouts, and confusing nutrition trends that just won't work for you. On The Planted Runner, I'll share exactly how to run faster, longer, and feel great doing it at any age, because you don't have time to waste. I'm Coach Claire Bartholik, and I went from not running at all in my late 30s to finishing a marathon in 2:58 at age 42, all on a plant-based diet. I've helped hundreds of runners achieve new personal records well into their 60s and even 70s with science-backed training, plant-based nutrition, and proven mental strength techniques. Each episode of The Planted Runner is like a private coaching session on the run where you'll learn from me and the guests I interview. You'll get actionable lessons to help you become a better runner every week and reach goals you never thought possible. Whether you're training for your first 5K or your 50th marathon, take along The Planted Runner on your next run. Let me show you how your best running is still ahead of you.
Fifth to third on the last restart before obviously eventually winning. Yeah, I mean, there was just everywhere you looked, there was somebody lining up another pass, like they figured something out.
Yeah, and I think you're right. There was a lot more courage shown on the Sunday race, and I don't know. I thought that you saw a couple examples of guys making the PJ1 work just slightly. If they only had two tires on there, there seemed like people could make it work.
There's
pretty
a few
well
who tried and did okay.
Yeah, Pato was definitely one of them. I thought that was pretty cool. I really liked the race. I mean, Pato almost threw it away when he was fighting with Power and had two wheels in the apron, which is a big no-go on a high bank track. So the fact that he saved that was pretty incredible. And yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'll kind of segue into my next rant here. I'm really glad Dixon didn't win that second race. I mean, obviously Scott Dixon's the GOAT, and obviously he's a phenomenal driver. There's nobody's taking that away from him. I just thought if there was ever a weekend where we didn't get qualifying, this is a really bad one to not have it. For the first race, there was no qualifying because it rained on Saturday, and they did ownership points, and I'm like, oh man, like Pelot got a point, and in Pelot's defense was fast in the race, but in practice he wasn't very quick. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, you know, if we did qualifying, like, you know, standard normal qualifying, I feel like Pelot would have qualified 12th. But since he didn't, he basically followed Dixon for most of the race and got a pretty good decent haul of points. And you got other guys in the back of the field who had really strong cars who just couldn't pass because it was just the conditions and the track surface and whatnot. So, you know, this wasn't like Iowa where you could just make your way up, or Indianapolis where you could just make your way up. Like, this is a ridiculously hard place to pass that first night on a relatively green track. So I was pretty bummed that I understand why there was no qualifying for Saturday. I just, as the fan in me, I was pretty bummed because I knew it would be a little bit processional. That second race, though, as Rossi and Daly ranted about, I have no idea why we didn't qualify. I mean, the race started at 4:15 Central Time, and there was nothing before that. So I know it's technically written in the rules that way. I just don't understand why we couldn't have them go qualify, because then it was like Dixon was on pole again, and he led like 130 some laps, and I was like, oh god, here we go again. Like, Dixon's gonna really come out of this with two wins without having, you know, I'm not saying he didn't work for it, he was just kind of in the front and minding his own business like the entire time. So I would have been quite disappointed if that's the way it had shaken out, because I don't feel like Dixon would have quote unquote deserved that. Kind of the worst weekend to have a rain out for qualifying, in my opinion.
Yeah, like, so, the race is at 4:15 Central Time. Why don't you do qualifying at 10? So that way, qualifying is essentially 10 to 11, let's say. So you've got 5 hours to, make any repairs if God forbid you have an accident. Like, and that's also enough time for teams to have, a little bit of downtime to rest before a race. So I don't know why we didn't do qualifying. I know technically it's in the rule book that way, but I don't agree with that one at all.
Yeah, and it's such a small sample to go in the weekend, having only had two races so far to, sort it by points. Like, I get the first race, there's not a whole lot you can do with the TV window and all that stuff, and the practice time was vital. But, let's, unfortunately say there is a 7-car pileup at the start of the race, as there was in the second race. Every single car that got taken out was already at the bottom of the points as far as the championship goes. So it was literally just like the rich got richer and the poor got poorer on Sunday. It was quite sad to see. I mean, and some of the guys in that poorer category, I don't think should be there. Kanaan shouldn't have been back there. He was fast.
Rossi
shouldn't have been back there. He was fast. Bourdais shouldn't have been back there. He was fast. So it was kind of just like a really unfortunate situation for some of the guys back there, because I don't feel like they belonged. But, given the circumstances, they started back there, and then there was a giant crash that they couldn't avoid. So really sucks for them. I it was just really bad circumstances. Last thing to rant about, obviously a big conversation piece of the weekend as we get to Texas every year, is how bad the track is now for IndyCar between the redesign of Turn 1 and 2. And the PJ1 that they threw on the high grooves to help make NASCAR quote unquote better has made everything worse. Eddie Gossage has come out on social media and stated that there will be no repave because it's virtually new. They can't grind it because that'll ruin the surface. They're experimenting with this substance that can potentially like suck the PJ1 out of the track. I'm no scientist, but I'm not really buying that. But he's adamant that they're not going to be repave. And if we're being honest with ourselves, given the financial state of IndyCar and how big of a supporter Eddie Gossage is of IndyCar, this track's not going anywhere. So I know some of you out there don't like the fact that IndyCar goes to Texas because it's not as good as it used to be. I think we maybe just need to adjust our expectations a little bit going forward, knowing that it might be a snooze, or it could be like Sunday. Sunday was actually a pretty fun race, all things given. So what are your thoughts about the political landscape with IndyCar in Texas and the fact that we might be kind of just stuck with this for the next decade?
So first thing is, I think it was Scott Dixon said he thinks, or Scott Dixon or Graham Rahal said he thinks if you just... that PJ1 will fade over the next couple of years anyway. Not that that makes anybody feel better, because that's still not tomorrow. But yeah, listen, IndyCar isn't going to go away from Texas because Eddie Gossage, IndyCar kind of needs Texas, and Eddie Gossage makes it happen. He was obviously willing to do a doubleheader, and so it is what it is on that front. The really confusing thing was last night he said what we saw on track isn't fair, but reality is traction compound for NASCAR will continue. And then today he said need to find technique or chemical that pulls traction compound out of pores of the asphalt. So does that mean he still wants the traction compound, but it not to sink into the track? I don't know. He said a few mixed signals things in the last 24 hours. And I don't know if that's because he's gotten maybe some pressure from IndyCar or something, but I don't know what the solution is. The only sort of logical and solution I heard all weekend was, okay, if we're going to have the traction compound, why don't we just make the whole, all of the turns, the entire turn top to bottom traction compound, at least that way it's even. But then my thought to that was, as I think about it, well, then the Indy cars would not be able to turn. So that would be a big disaster, even if you made the whole track traction compound. So maybe they just repave the corners, so all the corners are the same. But man, I don't know if it was NASCAR putting pressure on Texas or Texas putting pressure on NASCAR for a better show, but PJ1 might be the worst thing in racing in any like capacity.
Yeah, I don't think putting PJ1 down would help. I think it would make it, yeah. I think the cars would become undrivable then, which would be kind of sad. But I don't, yeah, I'm not sure what the solution is other than repave. But I don't, you know, like I said, I don't think this chemical suction thing that they're going to try, I don't know if that'll work. Yeah, like I said, I think we just kind of need to adjust our expectations. This track is going to race like a road course. It's just going to be at much higher speed. So you just have to time your passes. You have to, you know, there's a lot of corners and road courses where you can't go 2x2. So it's just one of those things where I think, you know, once they get adjusted to it, they just got to time their passes. I don't know if the aero bits that IndyCar added helped at all, but I don't think this is a problem that IndyCar has. I don't think it's a Firestone problem. I don't think it's a chassis problem. I really just think it's a track surface just sucks. Maybe higher horsepower so you can draft easier, which, you know, is coming with the hybrid era. So that may be on the horizon. But anyways, as far as the whole weekend goes, now we're done ranting. Who was your driver of the weekend?
Can you go first? Because I honestly, I'm trying to remember where everybody finished.
Yeah, I'll go with Pato with his first career win. Congrats, Pato. That's pretty awesome for you, man. Finished third in the first race, too, and had one of the best cars in traffic in that first race as well. So it's not like the second race was a fluke. He looked really strong all weekend. And bummer for his teammate, Felix Rosenquist, because his teammate looked really good too. He just didn't have the results to show for it. First race got kind of hosed with the Hinch yellow and Marcus having his pit issue. And the second race, they sent him out without a tire on. That really sucked. So Felix definitely had a stronger weekend than what the results show, but Pato did great too.
I will take Graham Rahal. Two top fives, including a podium. Had some real good pace all weekend, so I'll take Rahal.
Disappointment of the weekend, I am going to go with James Hinchcliffe. It's been a disappointing start to the year. Don't know if it's too much of a hot take. Makes me maybe wonder about Marco Andretti just a little bit. Marco Andretti didn't have very good results in this entry. Hinch is not having very good results in this entry. I don't know.
I'm going to leave this one open to interpretation for everybody else out there because I don't disagree.
Makes you go, just a little bit.
I'm going to take his teammate in Ryan Hunter-Reay, who finished 13th or 14th on Saturday, finished 10th on Sunday, but then again, like half the field was missing by the end of the race, so it was... He wasn't really ever competitive on Sunday. So Ryan Hunter-Reay also makes you go, maybe it's time to go,
Yeah, there's some hot seats forming between those two.
Ed Jones.
Felix maybe just a little bit. Ed Jones for sure. I think those are kind of the four on the hot seat right now. All right, recapping our predictions. Mike said Newgarden would do good. P6 and P2 were his results this weekend. I had Pagano P10 and P6. I'll give myself a little pat on the back because Pagano did get royally screwed by that first yellow in the first race. Yep. So the fact that he climbed back to 10th was pretty good, but you had the better one in that one. Bad. You had Rosenquist 13th asterisk and 16th asterisk, and I had Hinch 23 and 18. The second race we can kind of give him. I think he got damaged from that wreck. So yeah. His race was pretty much toast. But yeah, I think I definitely won that. And I think Felix actually ended up doing pretty good. So that was good. You nailed the dark horse though. Jack Harvey was brilliant all weekend. He was very fast. Running top five in the second race till his brakes failed, yeah. A la Herta race one. I had Kanaan. Kind of bummed about that because I don't think TK got to unleash his full potential this weekend.
No, it's unfortunate that he obviously didn't have the gearing set right on Saturday, and that kind of hampered his straightaway speed. And then Sunday, I don't know what happened, but he ended up in the pits at the end of the during the caution.
He was involved in a crash.
Oh, right. He had some wing damage, right?
So he had some wing damage. And then if you watch his onboard, I think he probably slammed on the brakes as anybody would have, and it like slid him into the tri-oval wall. Just he brushed it. So I'm assuming it probably knocked him out of alignment or something.
Yeah.
But while he didn't have catastrophic damage, I'm assuming he picked up enough to pretty much ruin his day. And he went three laps down immediately. So Right. Obviously that sucks. We'll move on, though. Something that doesn't suck is Stefan Wilson is in the sixth Andretti Autosport car for the Indianapolis 500. He's got, I think it's called Lola Brands. It's a golf attire.
Yeah.
Golf clothing company.
They are owned by team partner, co-owner Cusick Motorsports and Don Cusick.
So that's cool. So some of the other names floating around that seat were Oliver Askew and Oriel Servia, but it is Stefan Wilson who did run with this team in 2018. Did lead like the last couple.
Yeah, it was close.
The last laps of that race. Pretty insane. So congrats to Stefan. If you didn't see Mike chat with Stefan, that is on our podcast. So go check that out for some thoughts from Stefan on that. And then let's round out the episode with some happy news. Robert Wickens got to test a car at Mid-Ohio today. It's his first time back in a race seat in, I think, 989 days since his terrifying accident at Pocono. So that is enough to warm everybody's heart and cutting onions in the room, because that's pretty awesome for him, and he's just an inspiration for everybody.
Yeah, when... This is probably the best, you know, the best bit of news we can end an episode with. Stefan Wilson and Robert Wickens essentially in the same sentence. Yeah. Listen to my chat with Stefan. Thank you to Andretti PR, who reached out the night before the announcement to set that up with me. I was wholeheartedly appreciated. And Robert Wickens, man, what a story. I think he'll be racing at Mid-Ohio in a couple weeks, and I don't think I'll be able to make it out there, but I will definitely tune in. I unfortunately still remember every detail of being at Pocono that day, so I can't wait to see him make his return to the car. That'll be really, really cool to see. And hopefully his recovery is continuing well. It looks like it is, at least from social media, but I'm definitely... Some really nice happy moments to round out an episode where we've talked about Texas and other annoying things to start out the episode. But we'll wrap it up there unless, Matt, we have anything else. No? Matt, nice work in Texas this weekend. Can't wait to see the food reviews, even the one where you had the camera the wrong way.
they're all up and down.
Oh. Well, we'll just chalk this up to, you know, yeah, it was Texas.
My first one in like 9 months.
Yeah. Anyway, guys, there is F1 this weekend at Spain, so there's some racing to watch. I don't know, there might be NASCAR too. Not really going to be watching that one. So tune in to F1, and we'll be back next week to preview the GMR Grand Prix. Today's podcast was presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way for you to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. If you're a podcaster, you can apply too immediately and get connected with advertisers that fit your audience. Go to podgo.co at podgo.co and let them know that we sent you there.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.